now, our feature presentation.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of the Florida Sound Archive Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Kaiser, and for today's episode, I have two guests on here with me, and I'm very excited for this episode. I've got Brian Cleary and Johnny Lee. They are members of the Melbourne Beach, Florida band, Locals Only. Hey guys, welcome in.
Hey, what's happening?
This has been something I've been really anticipating because there's not a lot out there that you can find from Locals Only. So really hoping you can share with the listeners the history of the band, the story, because you all were pretty prominent in the Central Florida scene in the early and mid 80s.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun. When we first started, we were kids. Yeah, I was 14. I was too young to join the band. So there were 2 years I was in the band, but couldn't actually play in the band because my parents wouldn't buy me a keyboard because they didn't want me running off with these guys.
I was 16.
He was 16. Yeah. We were pretty young. The other Sal and Ed, singer and guitarist, were a little older than us. But yeah, we were all pretty young. But we also, you know, in terms of new wave and punk and that, there were no other bands in the area. There was a band called Disorderly Conduct. Casey Chaos later did Amen. And that was it. Locals Only and Disorderly Conduct for a while anyway.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And then by the mid 80s, other bands started forming. And,
right. We had this band that used to run around with us called the Body Bags.
Oh, the Body Bags. Yeah. They were hardcore band.
Yeah. Yeah. They were a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know, there were a bunch of friends that, you know, just pretty insane. But
were you guys into that kind of music too? More of the more hardcore punk sound?
Some of us. I mean, here and there. Robert liked a lot of it. I loved Jerry's Kids. I liked the FUs. Minor Threat, of course. I had my bands I liked, but it's not something I listened to a ton. It was just, I had to really be in the mood, basically. I was more into traditional punk rock, you know, the earlier punk rock, and then post-punk I was really into. That was my jam, if anything.
Were you guys friends, like, growing up? And how did you all meet?
Yeah.
And plus the other members of the band that may not be able to be here today?
Well, it's a long story. I mean, you know, it all started in a garage, you know, in our drummer's house. The guy that I used to play with he was a guitar player, or he decided he wanted to be a guitar player. And then wound up, you know, they started playing, you know, he had this drum set. He got out this drum set. We're like, why are you playing guitar, man?
Yeah, everyone plays guitar, dude.
Right. So we went through a bunch of high school friends and stuff until we got to this point where, you know, the drummer, Robert Jalowski, he invited this guy over that, you know, I gotta kind of like preface this because, you know, we're all just, you know, a bunch of young kids, and this guy comes over, you know, and I said, well, who is this guy? He's like, well, he's a high school dropout, and, you know, he plays guitar and he works for his dad at a roofing company. And I'm like, okay, yeah, that's great. My parents are going to love him. You know, so anyway, he started playing and he had this really angular style of guitar. I mean, it was very, he just kind of attacked the guitar, you know, from underneath it, you know, and on top of it. I mean, he just had this different, you know, and, you know, Brian and I both kind of looked at each other and went, this guy, I've never seen.
Yeah.
We got to play with this guy a little bit more and see where this goes. So
was he your age too? 16?
No, he was older. He was,
I was 17, 18.
Yeah. At the time I was 12. I didn't have a keyboard.
Wasn't that long ago,
yeah,
man.
Wow. Robert, the drummer, brought me over to Sal's house one day. I heard him play Needle in the Damage Done by Neil Young, just on his acoustic. And I loved Neil Young. I just discovered Neil Young. I was all about it. And then Robert brought him over to my house to hear me play piano. And I played Neil Young. I played Cortez the Killer.
Right,
I played
right.
all his solos note for note.
Right.
And Sal was like, you're in the band. He held my spot for the next 2 years until I could talk my parents into buying me a keyboard.
Yep.
Which was not easy. I mean, Sal dropped out in the eighth grade. Sal had hair down to his butt, pierced tattoos. No one had that back then. Like
right.
you either had none of that stuff or you were a biker, basically.
What does your family think of you hanging out with these dudes?
That's why it took me 2 years.
Right, exactly.
Basically, by the time I was turning 14, they knew I was going to either run away with the band, or if they bought me a keyboard, maybe they could sort of keep me under their roof. So they, you know, they fought it for a while, but I eventually got a keyboard, a little Casio. And yeah, I joined the beginning of 1982. Now we were a five-piece. The band had been playing for a couple of years already, but... And they were definitely getting a following already. Like, everyone in my junior high knew the band, knew Locals Only, and we played at every party that, you know, was going on. And then we started playing bars more. There was a place called the Boardwalk, which was in the Atlantic on the boardwalk.
Mostly cover songs at that point, or was it originals too, or a mix?
Half and half, I'd say. Yeah. Roughly half and half.
Let's say so. Yeah. By that time we had Ed.
Yeah, we had Ed singing and writing the songs. He and Sal wrote some stuff. Yeah, you know, we all wrote our parts and everything, but Ed was the main singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
So.
Do you remember the first song that you were a part of that Locals Only wrote?
That I was a part of? It might have actually been... I remember Ed brought two songs to practice once. One was The Danger Twist, which I think we started with there. And one was Everybody Dies was the other one. They just both blew my mind. It was a really fun time. It was real exciting playing back then. And
right.
We had actually had a singer before I was in the band. We played one or two gigs with him, Ernie Douglas. He had a real name, but we called him Ernie Douglas.
Yeah, Daryl Seach.
My three sons, you know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He looked like, yeah, he did, you know, he reminded everybody.
He really looked like Ernie Douglas. Yeah.
So, but, you know, actually, I still keep in touch with him. He's, you know, he, I don't think he's playing anymore, but anyway, long story short, yeah, he sang and
played saxophone,
right. But it just didn't go in the direction that,
yeah, that we were going,
that everybody else was going. And so, you know, Ed came along, and next thing I know, again, here we're adding this other incredibly weird personality, right? We got Sal, who plays this angular guitar stuff, right? And then, you know, got Ed, who's absolutely and totally, you know, he's
kind of a surf guitarist
with this this, you know, with a lot of these really cool vocal and you know, and lyric ideas. And I know, you know, we're turning these lyric ideas into songs, you know, and he's going, hey, Johnny, you know, what do you think about how should we arrange this? So I jumped into, you know, trying to figure out how to structure some of these songs. Like, for instance, one of the songs that I got an opportunity to work on was Monster Hole. It's an original and it's an instrumental, but, you know,
surf music.
It's all surf music, yeah. Right? So, you know, how do you arrange that? How do you, you know, how do you break it up so that you got a, you know, you've got a, you know, got an A section, a B section, you know, what do you use for the bridge? How do you pull all this together into something that, you know, is interesting, you know, that we can still, you know, that we can put out in front of people? And, you know, that was really, it was just trying to create excitement along the way in the song.
Yeah.
Talk about the influences for a minute, because when I first heard Locals Only, the first two bands that came to mind, actually three, to be honest with you, it was B-52s, Devo, and the Surf Punks. So,
of course, we actually covered two Surf Punk songs too.
Yeah,
and they put an album called Locals Only, their second album.
Maybe that's what it was for me. Maybe because that album too.
Maybe we should have put an album out called Surf Punk.
Exactly, then, that would have been perfect.
everybody would have been happy.
Yeah. But, The influences are all over the map, I'd say. You know, surf music was obviously a big one. The Ventures, you know, probably Dick Dale, Link Wray, whatever. But then there was a lot of new wave influence. Like you nailed it. I mean, Devo, B-52s, Split Ends, but
the Bongos.
Covered them. But we covered a Ramones. Well, we covered what we thought was a Ramones song. It was a Heartbreakers song that the Ramones covered, Chinese Rock.
So we covered a cover.
We covered a cover, exactly. same with Come On Everybody, which was a Sex Pistols song, but it was an Eddie Cochran song way right before that. We did that one. We covered Sex Pistols. Athletico Spiz, we did this song called Where's Captain Kirk? It was on that. Did you ever see the movie Erg, A Music War?
Yes.
It's on that. It's, to me, one of the best songs of the whole album.
Yeah,
I had the cassette back then, and I
nice
played it for the actually, band. And, yeah.
Actually, that changed my whole perspective on what I thought music was going to be for this band. It turned it from like the B-52s thing into, dude, that's got some energy. This thing's, you know, this kind of stuff. Oh, we got to go this direction.
Right.
You know?
Right. But I'd say, you know, a lot of the covers we did probably influenced our originals a little bit. But then there was, you know, probably a little, we had songs like, Summer Love, semi-romantic surf song, kind of a Beach Boys style, a little more, slower romantic style stuff. And then, yeah, the more new wave stuff. We had a few songs that were more, the song we'll end with is more in the punk vein of things too. But, you know, we'd play, it was funny because there was a period of time when we were still it. We'd play, and by now slam dancing had caught on and hardcore. So all the punks would come to our shows because you didn't have any other bands to see in the air.
Right.
And they were all slam dancing and everything to our like surf music songs, which is kind of weird. And they'd be yelling like, faster, faster. And I remember Ed once, he just gets up on the mic. He's like, you want fast, go to a racetrack. Well, and goes into the next song, you know? So we weren't, you know, your run of the mill punk band exactly. We were definitely outside of that, probably more of a surf new wave band, if anything.
Right. Talk about the lyrics for a minute, because on some of the songs, one could get the idea that there was some sci-fi influence, and perhaps sure. you all oh, may yeah. have been into like that sort of thing, maybe comic books or whatever the case may be.
Yeah,
plus, you know, you're not that far, right? Kind of in the Space Coast part of the state. So yeah. I'm not sure if that had any influence at all on your music. So perhaps you can shed some light on that.
I think, you know, there were a lot of different influences going on. I think a lot of there was this sci-fi influence, you know, there was this comic book influence with, you know, with Dick Tracy. There was this sci-fi influence with stuff like the Danger Twist. And then there was this heartfelt stuff that Ed was writing when he was just trying to cope with, you know, trying to become a human, you know, because we're 16, 17 years old. But I mean, like, for instance, Summer Love, you know, hey, girl, what's on your mind? It's in your eyes. I'm not blind. You got something to say to me. Oh, Lord, what can it be? You know, I mean, stuff like that yeah. was just those types of things were, you know, were it, especially, you know, when you're a teenager, those types of things were, you know, your greatest fears and,
right.
you know, and how to find a way of managing to that, you know, but also bringing in fun, you know, and that party and that jubilation, like, you know, the Danger Twist, you know, I'm pre-imagining, you know, the Lost in Space robot.
That was what it was about. Oh. That was the dance he did.
Right.
So we had everyone in the audience doing the Danger Twist, basically. That was like a thing for a while.
Right. Absolutely. And then there was, you know, like Dick Tracy, where everybody would just go absolutely, you know, bonkers. Yeah. Dick Tracy, he's the man with the plan. He flies around in a cosmic trash can. I mean, you know,
Then we had our less romantic songs, like
right.
All you people think you're so cool. Hey, that might be so, but sooner or later, probably sooner. Hey, all you gotta go because everybody dies. And that was the chorus, you know?
Right.
So that's very punk, you know? That's a very punk.
Very, very punk, yes.
And that came from, I think that was, Ed took a class at BCC and the teacher said, and someone in the class, give me an indisputable fact. And his was Everybody Dies. And then basically that's where the lyrics
came from. Right. That's where it came from. You know?
Talk about the Brevard County scene at that time. You know, other bands that were more contemporaries or maybe bands you remember seeing when you were up and coming in the scene. Who comes to mind?
Well, there was when we started, it was all Southern rock. I mean, there was Southern rock and
we had Southern rock. Then there was the Southern rock band. Then there was the blues band. And then there was like this other band that was playing, you know, covers of, it was like a three piece playing covers of, the latest rock and roll, you know, John Cougar and whatever was, you know, was popular during the day.
Right.
Chuck, you know, Tramp. So we came to it and here's really interesting. The influences as far as that goes, where those influence didn't come from the people that we were, you know, that were playing locally. A lot of those influences came from, you know, this extended family of friends that we surrounded ourselves with. And Brian can talk a little bit more about that with like, how was it? What's his name? I just died. I'm sorry.
Oh God. Oh, Craig Buck. No, but Captain Beef.
Right. Yeah. So Beef and
Everyone had a nickname in the scene. There was so many. Our first manager was TJ the DJ. There was Tourist Tom, Retail Rob, Captain Beef.
Everybody had a nickname.
Yeah, everyone.
Mine was Johnny Rotten.
I was Boy Wonder.
Right. I mean, you just that's just how it was, right?
Yeah. But it was a fun scene. I mean, it was sort of, our scene was the surf scene, surf and skate scene mostly. We, you know, people like Mark Lake would always come to our shows. Buddy Lamas showed up at some of our shows. We, you know, pro surfers, skaters, and just locals, basically the local surf scene. In terms of the local music scene, like I said, when we first started out, there was other rock bands. Like we opened for this band Stranger, we were supposed to open for the Ramones. There was going to be a show at the Tape Deck parking lot, which is right across from Melbourne High. They canceled out and we wound up opening for Johnny Van Zant instead.
Right.
But, and we did open for the Atlanta Rhythm Section.
We did. We opened for the Atlanta Rhythm Section.
You know, remember them?
That was the first time we ever played with some group that was like, you know, we're all like, oh shit, these guys are like professionals. They have like records and shit out, you know.
I'm pretty sure they opened up for Skynyrd when Skynyrd played.
I think they did
Lake City. I think that was like one of the most infamous shows because it was like 2 days before the plane crashed.
So, oh wow, that's right.
I hope I'm not mistaken on that, but I'm pretty sure. I think it was around that time they played. I think Lake City, Florida, but the Atlantic's Rhythm Band, is that Atlantic
Rhythm Section?
They opened that show with I think one other band with Skynyrd.
You're right. I just saw the Skynyrd documentary actually. Yeah,
right.
We were talking about that.
There was another guy that we used to see all the time. His name was Dave Feaster.
Oh yeah.
It was just Snooks. A monster. Yeah, the Snooks. He was a monster guitar player. Yeah. I mean, absolutely, but he didn't play. You know, I mean, this had nothing to do with punk or new wave or anything that we were in.
Blues and Southern rock. But then later, by like I'd say 83, 84, 85, bands started popping up. There was this guy Greg Reinel had a band called Screaming Iguanas of Love.
Yeah, he was great.
They were a lot of fun. There was the Scooby Doos. Gary Gnu. There was a band called Red Scare. They were sort of like an R&B band. Whereas, you know, Screaming Iguanas were more of like a power pop, but modernized power pop. Really cool.
Talk about that band we opened for. Was it Sleep of Reason?
Oh, so yeah. He just did an interview with the singer, Oscar Herrera. That was funny. I was tuning in and I was like, whoa. So we played with Sleep of Reason a couple times at the FIT Rathskeller. And they
also opened for them at Brassies when they were doing an album.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And another band called Insect Surfers from DC, who actually ran into the singer out in LA. He still had the band going.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Really? No, that's kidding. Awesome.
I'm trying to think of other local bands that were around at the time. Well, there was Disorderly Conduct, of course, the Body Bags we mentioned.
So all these bands were just, you know, I mean, we kind of like broke that open a lot. I mean, it got to a point where, you know, there were you know, there were bars who were hiring these guys now, and parties where people were playing these parties now.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of that stuff, I don't remember it being true before, you know, we were doing any of that.
Right.
Am I right?
No, the scene was kind of, there was more and more of a scene. WFIT was becoming more and more popular.
Absolutely.
Alternative music in general was just blowing up in the air. It got to a point whereby I'd say 85, 86, if you walked down the beach, everyone had WFIT cranked on their boom boxes or whatnot. And we were on WFIT. We were, I think, in the playlist for a while. We recorded an album, but we never released it. WFIT was the only station that ever had it, actually.
Do you remember what DJ or DJs at WFIT were kind of pushing locals only?
Yeah.
Or maybe just local music in general at that time?
Oh, yeah. God, there was John Hammerlin, the music director, big time. There was Tommy Khalil, who played a lot of local stuff.
Right.
I mean, really a lot of them. You know, Andy Hughes, Yogi came along later. He wasn't doing radio yet. Ron Quinn, he went by Ron Anthony, Lou Daniels, John Pernick, who was the GM. Mm-hmm. He was a big fan. We had a lot of fan, you know, people who loved us until, you know, we'd play a show for them and like trash their place or something.
Right. Yeah. There was always that.
There were always two shows
going on.
Right. This is a bit of a tangent, but we played in Miami in 1981 at Bowdoer Fashion College, which was like 900 girls studying to be models or fashion designers and us. And we got banned from the campus pretty much right away after that show. But then they moved the campus from Miami to Fort Lauderdale. So the same girls had us back again because they didn't know in Lauderdale that we were banned from there. So, yeah.
Why were you banned?
I don't remember. God, do you?
It might have had something to do with Ed and Sal sleeping in the big bass cabinets that we brought.
We had our own PA that we built. It was huge. Yeah, you could fit a human in there.
Yeah, they basically set up like pillows and whatnot because
really?
none of the girls wanted to have anything to do with them at the time because Sal had a mohawk.
Oh, right.
And Ed was, you know, busy running around being too cool for school. So, it was definitely an interesting time.
Yeah.
Was that the first time you were in Miami playing a show, or did you go down south, maybe Fort Lauderdale or Palm Beach?
That was the only time. The only time we ever played in Fort Lauderdale or Miami were at Bowdoer Fashion College.
How did that show come about? Like, who brought you down there?
Nina Teviani.
Yeah, it was. How did we know? I think she had family in Melbourne.
Yeah,
and wound up at one of our shows and asked us to play in Miami at her college. Basically, she was like the, you know, sorority leader or something or whatever. But so that, I think that's how that came about.
Well, and she knew Sal really well, and that's
really well. Yeah. Yeah, that's how that came about. Outside of that, we played in Ormond Beach once, a place called the Beach Club.
Mm-hmm.
We played in Orlando a few times. We used to play at a place called Decades. And then at Brazil's, we played once. Outside of that, I don't remember playing outside of Brevard County.
No, we played, I mean, that, you know, the Orlando stuff was all surrounding the college there in Winter Park.
Rollins,
which escapes my mind. But, you know, I walked in there and said, you guys need a band. And there, you know, there was, you know, this poor woman who was pining over her lost lover, singing to the jukebox to,
I never want to
George,
dance again.
Right. George Michael. I never want to dance again. And I said, this woman, I said, yeah, this bar needs a band because this isn't going to work.
Right.
Right.
So, yeah. So we played there and that was great. They had us back again. Yeah. Basically, if we didn't trash the place, they'd have us back or if, you know, but then there was like the FIT Rat. We got banned from there because one night we played there and a riot broke out towards the end of the set. The place was just, they over capacitated the place basically. And it was like surfers and FIT students and it just clashed.
It did not
kind of blew up. I'll never forget. We're playing the song Physical by Adam and the Ants towards the end of the set, so we didn't get if they're missing that, but And there was just so much energy building up in the place that the lid just blew off. And Ed threw his guitar through Robert's bass drum. Sal smashed his guitar. I'm just like hovering over my keyboards to keep somebody from like falling over into them. And it went from slam dancing to basically a big brawl. So wow. That was the last time we played the Rat.
Oh, it's just a bummer. Oh, yeah. Well.
What can you do?
I don't know.
Now, there's another place that I'm familiar with that I know a lot of bands are playing, but it was, I think it may have been more in Orlando, Sleep Out Louie's.
Played there.
We did play there. Who did we play there with? That was where we played with TSOL.
Right. TSOL.
And Marginal Man.
Marginal Man. We also played with this group. The guy that promoted those bands used to play with a band called Noise for the Needy. I don't know if you've ever heard of them. But I can't remember the guy's name.
Yeah.
I wish I could. But he invited us over to, you know, to play, to open for some of these guys. And, you know, I mean, compared to some of the bands that they had coming in there, we looked like a bunch of Jehovah's Witnesses, you know?
Yeah, that was by like 84, 85. So punk had finally really taken off in Florida. You know, everything took about 3 or 4 years to get to Florida, you know, after it would get to the rest of the country. That's changed now, but it, like, bands used to just go down to Georgia and skip right over Florida. And
right.
WFIP started changing that. I think had a lot to do with changing that, bringing in more bands, putting on shows and stuff.
We had college radio finally, you know, became something.
Right. Exactly.
Was there anyone in particular who you felt was doing more of that promoter work that was really trying to bring in some bands, at least getting them to at least come through the Melbourne area or just around the general vicinity?
There was this guy. Oh God. What was, Ron DeLoach.
But that wasn't, he wasn't bringing in punk bands.
No,
that
he wasn't bringing in punk
bands.
Glam
metal.
He was like glam metal and all kinds of other stuff, but
we used to call him Ron the Roach.
Right. Yeah. But that's that. Yeah. We don't disparage people.
I know. This is 40 years.
But as far as like, you know, promoters in this area bringing in that kind of music, it was a lot of it was just based around the college. I mean,
FIT had a lot to do with bringing band. There was, I can't think of a local promoter that was like booking all the shows, bringing band. It was really people from WFIT, Helen Uriola, John Pernick, John Hammerlin.
Yeah.
They really kind of banded together to, bring in a lot of these bands. I'm sure there were punk rock promoters that, you know, later on got, you know, more prominent in that, but not at the time. It was just whatever we could get, basically. And even if bands came into Florida, Melbourne was not their first stop, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Usually that on the way down, right. Or maybe on the way back up or something like that.
I learned why touring. I toured through Florida with the movies and this band called Trans Am. We were touring with them, and the drives are so long between cities in Florida. It was like crazy. It's like Texas, basically.
Yeah. I know not a Florida band, but I'm a fan of Trans Am and a lot of those thrill jockey kind of bands. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I love that stuff. They were super fun to tour. We toured with them twice, actually. They were great.
Nice.
They're still around, actually.
Very cool. So where do you remember practicing as a band?
Oh God.
Oh, that's a great
garage
question.
To garage. We started at Jalowski's in the living room and then in your house.
Right. So yeah, that was a great story. We practiced in my garage and my parents wanted that because at least they could keep an eye on us. Right. They wanted to make sure that, you know, at least if I was going to be a part of this, you know, a bunch of crazy, you know, this crazy thing that they wanted, you know, it's like, keep close. Right. That was until they would get anonymous calls from the neighbors saying, if you people don't stop that music, I'm going to blow your house up.
Wow. Yeah.
So then we had to kind of figure out something else. I mean, practice.
Oh, then we practiced in Georgia's Spectrum Surf. So the punk new wave scene in Melbourne at the time was kind of locals only Spectrum Surf Shop. And we all hung out together, together. Then we played at Spectrum a lot, actually, out in either the parking lot or on this platform between the two buildings. It was like probably not safe at all.
Probably the most dangerous thing that we've ever done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where was I going with that?
We were going with where we practiced.
Georgia's. Yeah. We practiced in this tiny, tiny apartment. You could barely fit five people in the apartment, never mind all our gear. And then we practiced back at, where did we practice after that? God, I don't remember. Oh, wherever Sal was living,
Right,
basically.
wherever Sal was living. At one point, Sal was living in this house on the ocean. You know, I wasn't old enough to drive at the time. I said, my dad, I said, you know, I got to go to practice tonight, and it's down down in Sebastian Inlet area. You know, I'm like, and at the time, you know, Sal's living with, you know, all these other guys, right? And they're renting this house directly on the ocean. I mean, you roll up to this place and it looks like, you know, it just looked like something out of, you know, Miami Vice, with, you know, some cocaine dealer's house.
Well, not that nice.
You remember that house?
It was a shack, dude.
No.
Literally the floors went out
That
from
was
just.
First Avenue. That
Oh,
was
you're talking about a different beach
I'm
place.
talking about South Melbourne
Oh,
Beach.
okay.
They had
I
this
do remember that.
place. And then we started then he got this place over on First Ave in
That was more of just a hangout. We didn't practice it. And then we started practicing
he
at the
called it
Hustler.
Butch, was it wasn't that Butchie's Barf and
Butchie's
Grill?
Bar from Grill,
Right.
exactly. And that's now a restaurant, huge, like two-story restaurant in Melbourne Beach.
Right.
But and then we were practicing at the bar. We started playing at this place, the Hustler, a lot towards
Right.
the end, and they just let us leave our equipment set up because they didn't have any other bands playing there. So
Right.
we'd practice there during
When
the
you
day.
say towards the end, what year is this?
Okay, so that would be
80,
86.
86, 87
We
ish.
played, yeah, we so we played two last shows in 86. And then we thought it was our last show, and then we got reminded that we promised to play at a friend's birthday party, which was 87. So we did play one show later in 87 in the year, but that
Was
was the only show we played that year.
that birthday party at like a house or was that at a
Yeah,
club or
no, it was in a house in a backyard
what
in
was that
Melbourne.
like?
That was crazy. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, that by then, you know, the band had grown up. We the Sal and Ed had kids. Everything things were changing, and Melbourne, this whole scene had been kind of changing a lot. It sort of took a turn for the darker, I would say.
It took a turn towards like more kind of like metal kind of things. Like you had guys
Yeah,
like
a lot of metal.
you had this guy, what was his name? Chris Long. His name was Chris Long. You would know him by Dead Serious,
Oh, Dead Serious. I forgot about that. Oh,
right?
yeah.
So that became really pop. Those guys became extremely popular. I
Did
mean, they started working with guys that were, you know, actually,
they? Big.
yeah, you
Cool.
know.
But yeah, that was 86 was our last year, basically. Yeah, things had just changed. And our music was changing too. Like the songwriting was getting a little more serious, a little more subdued in a lot of ways. And then when we broke up, Ed, the singer, formed a band with this drummer, David Setgas, great drummer and still around. And then Greg from the Sleep of Reason, they were called Brave New Tribe. And they put out an EP, I think in 88 or so.
Yeah,
Yeah.
80, I want to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, things had evolved over the years. And, you know, I dropped out of high school in 1986 because I was going to be a big rock star with Locals Only. And then we broke up like 3 months later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. I always make great career decisions.
Well, I'm interested to know as well because it is kind of strange to me that there's not a lot of music you could find. I never came across a Locals Only cassette or a 7-inch or anything from the band. So was there anything ever recorded with the intention to put it out? Or maybe there even was a demo tape, but maybe talk about that a little bit.
We recorded an album in 1984, Hummingbird Studios, 16 songs. We sent it to one label and they never wrote back. That was it.
Was that Slash Records?
Was Slash Records, exactly.
Okay. I think it was.
There's the LA story. So one summer, I think it was in 83, Sal and sort of the guy who did sound for us, Keith Carson.
And Ed, right?
No, Ed didn't go.
Oh, I thought
Ed
it.
loaned them his car.
Right.
But which broke down in Texas, so they had to hitchhike through the desert to the rest of the for the rest of the way to LA. Sal's cousin friend knew a guy who booked the whiskey. I think he was the owner of the whiskey or something like that.
Right.
And Sal goes in and plays in the tape. Guy loves it. He says, God, we're getting all these girl bands in now, the Go-Go's or something, and the Bangle. We want to get some more of this punk rock stuff. So he's like, when can you get out here? And he gave us an open door, and basically our moms wouldn't let us go.
Right. Hey, I was giving you this Go-Go's. Look, I don't like girl bands, so
yeah,
listen.
Yeah.
You can have their slot, right? So, you know, it was...
So, yeah, we blew that.
Yeah, we did. Thanks, Mom.
Yeah. I talked to Sal recently, and Mom. He thinks we might still have an open door.
Oh, that's great.
I think so.
Actually, really, I would like to thank my mom for not letting me go, because my life would be completely different, and I might actually be dead right now.
It's true. So, it's true.
Yeah.
Saved your life.
She did.
Yeah.
There you go. So that's interesting, though, to learn more about that. And that album, so what? It's just been sitting somewhere shelved for all these years?
Ed found some of the old, they had transferred a lot of the stuff, the 2-inch reels, to VHS tapes, but I think they just disintegrated over time. We had him on something that he had mastered and run through a process. So we have that stuff now.
I still have some MP3s. I mean, most of the songs.
MP3s. Oh no, I have it all. I have all the stuff. I have a bunch of live stuff. We just haven't done anything with it. I'm hoping now that I'm back here, we can start at least talking about it. You can't really sell albums anymore, but you can put it up on Spotify and people can hear it. And that's all we really care.
Or you can do like a Bandcamp or something like that.
And,
Did you actually have artwork for this too? Like, did you actually have it almost ready to go, or was it kind of just in the process? You were just kind of,
We just recorded it. We never did come up with a cover. We never got that far along. You know, and nowadays it would be a different story. We probably would have recorded it ourselves. We could put it out ourselves. There's so many more mediums and venues to do that through. Back then, there were indie labels, but not in Florida.
Yeah, and not really.
They mostly catered to bands in their area or, you know, bands across the sea. But, you know, in hindsight, I would have sent it out to 50 labels or whatever to see if any of it came back. I think something would have, but we literally sent it, I think, to one label, and that was it. I think at the time we thought if we just keep playing out and keep it going, eventually somebody will want to put us out, and just never came to that, really. You know, I don't think talent scouts were like mining Melbourne for all the latest.
Not really.
Sounds back then.
Yeah, so, probably. Right. Probably not, right? So, but
with like going to Fort Pierce to find, you know, the best new wave band that you could ever, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Right. Know? Yeah. Unless you're
lots of meth, but not a lot of
new wave bands. No, there's a lot of, I like my teeth. So,
I like my teeth.
Danger Twist is a song we mentioned a little bit before. Yep. Was that song, would that have been part of the album?
Absolutely. Yeah. Those were the only studio recordings we did, those 16 songs. We did one, it was all originals and one cover. It was 96 Tears by Question Mark and the Mysterians. That was the only cover we did on it. I'll send you a copy of all the stuff. Fun. And definitely we would like to get it up and out at some point. Just hasn't happened.
Get it on Spotify. I don't care. Let's just get it out there so that at some point it gets some air,
People totally. Can hear.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like there's some good stuff to hear from what I've heard already. And I absolutely, again, selfish for me, I want artwork. just to kind of see what would you come up with now, and how would you kind of revisit that all these years later, and what would you come up with that kind of fits the theme of the album. So
one of the things that was that ran through the core of the songs that we wrote as a band was there's two things. There was this drive part. There's always this drive part. And then there was always some sort of counterpoint that ran over top of it. Just like you heard with this song, with Danger Twist, there's this ethereal part that would float over top of that, you know? And that was very much how, I would say one of the things that we were really good at as a band was being, you know, arrangers. I mean, we really were really good at arranging, you know, the songs and arranging the parts and coming up with things that would complement each other, but yet be completely, totally different and unique to each other. And I think that's very true and exemplary of what, you know, Danger Twist was.
Yeah. This is the actual keyboard that I use in that song. I still have it. I got my first keyboard when I was turning 14, and I got this the following year. And this was an actual synthesizer. It's a Yamaha CS-01. It was like a beginner's synthesizer, but it's awesome. I still use it. But anyway, and it's never had a case. It's fallen off the other keyboard about 80 times. It's had beer spilt on it, and it still
Wow.
works like a charm. Yeah.
Now, was that your beer or someone else's beer? Or
God only
because you
knows.
could because you
Yeah.
were pretty young back then,
I
right?
was pretty young. Well, it's funny, I looked older than I was.
Okay.
I was so the bartenders never questioned me. Because they were all like, by the time I joined, they were like 18, 19, which 19 was the drinking age in Florida back then. So after I played around with the band just a few places, I was able to get into all the bars anytime, even when we weren't playing, because we
Right.
knew the doormen by then and the bartenders, and they'd, hey, how's it going? You know, they knew me. And I never got carded until I was like 19 or 20, and the drinking age had changed to 21. There was like 2 years I couldn't go to bars anymore.
Was insane.
Yeah.
That's
Anyway.
very ironic. That's usually how it works out.
Yeah, back when
Exactly.
we was fab, when we had
Right.
hair.
That was fun. Yeah. I can't see it.
Did that affect, though, you wanting to go to maybe check out more bands, whether they were local or
Yeah.
whether they were coming
Oh,
in,
yeah.
maybe more
Yeah.
like national bands who were coming from out of town, that sort of thing? Because a
Sure.
lot of places back then were not all ages, right? So
Right.
how did that affect the shows you were going to? Did you miss anybody that you really wanted to see along the way?
I would most of the shows that I remember going to in Florida back then were in Boston, actually, because I spent my summers up in Boston. So I would sneak into clubs up there. I saw Husker Du in 1984. I saw, oh God, there's a band, the Liars, LYRES. I used to see a lot. They were, you know, used to be DMZ. A lot of Boston bands, and I was really into Boston rock at the time. But then there were, yeah, bands from out of town too.
So one of the bands, I can tell you this, one of the things that I remember taking a road trip to Orlando. Remember the Orlando Seminole High Life Ronton?
I don't remember it
Okay.
firsthand, but I have read about it.
So this was in 82, maybe 83, just after the US Festival.
Okay. Yeah.
And U2 was on tour, and we all went over because, you know, we heard this great band of this great band. We had these, you know, we were listening to these recordings and stuff. We're like, dude, these guys are fucking amazing. We gotta check this out. So we went over there. I remember very clearly it was they, if I'm not mistaken, I think they opened for Flock of Seagulls.
Yeah.
Okay, U2 opening for a
Flock
Flock
of
of
Seagulls. That's
Seagulls.
pretty
Okay,
funny.
it should have been the other way around because those
Sure.
guys were absolutely, I thought they were great. I
Yeah.
really did.
Although I don't know if Flock of Seagulls just maybe had a bigger hit at the time or
It's
whatever the case
exactly.
was.
Yeah, U2 hadn't even put out War yet, I don't think. Or
No.
maybe they just put out War, which is kind of their breakout album.
Right.
But the band, they all went to see, a lot of them went to see Devo, I remember,
Yeah, Devo.
B-52s and the Bongos.
Yep.
But there just wasn't a lot of bands like that were not coming to
They were,
Florida for the most
yeah, they were
part.
really traveling here.
That's why I had to go to Boston to see them. And then I did a radio show on WFIT. I started doing when I was 15, so that was 83. So that's how I was turned on to a lot of bands that way. But I was and playing, you know, promoting stuff, but also going up to Boston and taping the college radio stations up
Yeah.
there. That's where I was discovering a lot of this more obscure stuff that we got into.
The
And then
Brian Eno and
right.
the, you
And
know.
then with Spectrum Surf Shop, Whitney Bobbitt was sending tapes to the shop, and like all the team, the surf team, and all of us hung out there, and so a lot of them lived there. So they had a
Yeah.
part. So they'd have these Adam and the Ants import cassettes and like all this cool rare stuff. So we got exposed to a lot of music that in Melbourne, we were probably the only people listening to it, to be honest. You know,
it's probably true.
But
it's almost like your own little secret, you know, like only you're in on it, you know. So it kind of feels, especially at that age, right? You feel like, oh, this is like our secret society here, you know?
Oh, yeah. Like if there was a guy with a Maxell cassette tape that had like Joy Division on one side and Bauhaus on the other, but that was the only one in the whole, you had to borrow it from him or get a tape to tape thing.
Right.
Or whatever,
exactly.
You couldn't find it anywhere around here. There was no internet to order it from. I had to go to Boston to buy a lot of my records to find them there. Or I remember mail ordering a cassette tape of Bauhaus from the record bar in Melbourne Square Mall. And a month later, I had to get a ride from my mom out to go and buy the thing. And it was like gold, you know, like it was, you couldn't even hear it anywhere.
Except a couple of radio. Crazy. Yeah.
Right. Do you remember any pirate radio that was around back then that you may have been listening to, or was that non-existent?
Didn't have that. We didn't have that around. I mean, maybe it did and we didn't know about it, but it would have been easy to do here too.
It probably would have been no interference.
It's like just float out at sea and do it. I'm sure people did it, but I was never aware of it.
Yeah, the distribution of those types of, I mean, that was all hand to hand. I mean, it really was. It was, hey, you got to listen to this. Here, check this out.
Right.
Hey, you got to listen to this. Here, check this out. I mean, that's how it all passed around. And then we'd start playing some of this stuff, you know, and people would be like, who played that stuff? How's that? You know, hey, you guys wrote that. I'm like, no, we didn't write that. But here, you got to check this out. And next thing I know, you know, that's how a lot of the music kind of got disseminated, was, you know, through our, you know, basically through our, you know, our Coconut Telegraph.
Sure. Right. Now, another way the word gets spread through zines, right? Those publications that were helping spread the word. So the Funk Pop and Roll zine, was that a local zine from the Central Florida area? And perhaps maybe talk about that and what other zines you think were around back then that may have also helped to spread the word for some bands in the area.
Yeah, that was it.
I
think they only put out three issues, actually. I wrote record reviews for them. I was 16 by now. I remember I reviewed a Killing Joke EP, or reviewed the Chameleons, Rain Parade, mm-hmm. King Crimson.
We didn't have Brevard Live.
There was no zines. There were no, and we were mentioned in Surfer magazine, or Surfing or Surfer, at the very end of the thing. They called us the Surfing Symphony.
And then Florida Today or whatever.
Oh, Florida Today we were in. Yeah. But there were no punk zines or anything, because there was no scene. I think later years, well, that actually, Funk Pop and Roll didn't even come out till 84.
No.
So, yeah, after that, I'm guessing some came out, but not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy like that. But
yeah, there wasn't really, you know, WFIT was really it in terms of where you could promote your music, where people could hear that you're playing, you know, the concert reports. That was it. And that whole, they pulled the rug out from the community in 1992 or three, and they went all jazz.
Right.
There was more money in it. And it was really a bummer, because the whole community was just all about WFIT, and we were bringing in Ministry, Peter Murphy, mm-hmm. like all these great bands, the Church. I could go on, but we'd pack the Melbourne Auditorium with these shows.
Right, I remember that.
You know, and then
was that the largest venue in terms of capacity at that time?
I would say so, Melbourne Auditorium. Yeah, and I don't remember how big that was.
Right, other than like an outdoor park type thing that we, you know, where we, you know, we did a couple of those. But
I was thinking about that, right? Because there was like an outdoor kind of festival that existed also. I don't know if it still does, but it was in Brevard County. Is that right?
Yeah, there's one coming up in April, actually, that WFIT sponsors. I forgot what it's called. They do it around downtown Melbourne, I think. I'll be out of town for that, unfortunately. But yeah. And then we played at a surf contest once for like literally 20,000 people. I'll never forget that. My mom and Mrs. Jalowski dropped Robert and I off, and they dropped us off right off A1A by Ron Johns. And all you could see is the backdrop for the stage. So we're behind the stage. You couldn't see any of the audience. And I, you know, we meet up with the band and everything, and Sal and Ed pulled me under the stage, and, we smoked something, and then they Ed's like, come here, and he pulls back the canvas under the stage so I could see out at the audience. I had no idea how many people. I still hadn't seen the audience. I look out, there's 20,000 people there.
There were.
And now my paranoia is like, and I, yeah, that was one of my first shows too. Actually.
Was that the biggest crowd you remember ever having?
That was definitely the biggest crowd we ever played for.
Yeah.
It was like 20,000 people. What happened was John Sebastian was supposed to play that Sunday. And we took his time slot because he couldn't make it. I don't know why.
Yeah.
He couldn't get there in time.
There were a lot of disappointed soccer moms that
there were. There were a lot of you know, and right. You know, Welcome Back, Cotter wasn't getting played. So you know, and instead they had to opt for, you know, us doing the Danger Twist. So
yeah, that was it. That was that. We went through like four managers, I think.
Yeah, we did. We went through a lot of managers.
Robert's brother, TJ, the DJ, No Bar Too Far. Then we had Tommy Smith.
Right. Papa Smurf.
Oh, George Jones, not the country singer.
Not the country singer.
He was before Tommy.
Right.
And then Scotty Hewitt.
Right.
He had a band called the Tin Can.
Got a lot.
Yeah.
Right.
Remember the
What was the role of the person who was the manager? Like, what was their primary focus?
We can't talk about that.
His job was to manage the turmoil that surrounds the band.
Yeah. That was the term that became a.
That's right.
The turmoil that surrounds the band. Because there was a lot of it. There was a lot of it. It's funny. I was spoiled. Like, we had everyone set up our gear for us, carried our gear for us, did sound. We just had to show up and play for the most, towards the last, you know, 5-6 years. That never happened again. I played in a lot of bands after that, and that never happened.
No,
again. That doesn't happen until you're pretty big now. But it was, it was a blast. We had a blast. I mean, Melbourne was a fun town at the time.
Like I was saying before, I thought that all these other bands, this was happening to all these other bands, right? So I just kind of took it as normal.
Right.
Once I realized that what we were doing was completely different, and that, you know, there weren't 1,000, you know, screaming high school girls coming to see, you know, Mint Condition, you know, at the Purple Porpoise. It dawned on me that we had something, that there was something special going on.
We have some weird bar names around here. The Purple Porpoise, Squid Lips, the Thirsty Turtle. It always involves an animal.
Yeah,
right.
Plus, you're also by the beach. They're very oceanic names. Very suited for Florida too. You know,
exactly.
So makes sense.
Yeah. Definitely
makes sense.
Yeah. So, I know on YouTube there are some videos of later gigs. So there had to have been a reunion at some point.
We did two of those.
Yeah, we did.
Was that with all the original members or?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, 2009 and 2012. And it was great because when we first got together to practice for the first one, we hadn't been in the same room together for 34 years, I think.
It was like something like that. Yeah, 30 years.
And we were in the Jalowski's living room, exactly like the first place we ever formed and practiced.
Absolutely.
So it was really cool. We had a blast. We played at this place. It used to be The Hustler. Now it's called Bar Ruse.
No longer there.
Yeah. 2009 and 2012. Those were a lot of fun. I don't foresee that happening again, but you know.
Whose idea was that to kind of reform for those reunions?
That was Ed's idea.
I don't know. Yeah. I think we had started a MySpace page, which was the first time in 20, 30 years that people were from our scene and from that scene were kind of brought together and communicating.
Right.
And then it was a matter of time. Yeah. Ed put it together. And
remember, there's no Facebook, right? There was no Facebook.
It was MySpace, though.
Well, there was MySpace.
Back when we were doing all this stuff, you know, everything was through word of mouth and, you know, by the telephone. And, you know, I mean, people... There was no social media. There was no, oh my God, they're playing, and you know, I'm just looking at my phone. It just didn't work that way.
Yeah. But those shows were a lot of fun. A lot of the old crowd came out, and people were dancing again. Now they were like 40 and 50 somethings.
Sure. Great. So I saw a lot of walkers.
A lot of hospitalization.
Yeah, a lot of hospitalization.
Because so much had changed, right? You mentioned about now social media was your way to get the word out, right? So how did you get the word out to let people know, hey, we're playing a reunion show, you know, 30 plus years later? Like, how did you get the word out to let your fans know you were playing again?
For the whole thing, that was all MySpace. Everybody just like, you know, that all kind of came together very organically. It was like all of a sudden, you know, somebody said, hey, I think you guys need to do a reunion. You know, next right. thing I know, Ed's going, you know, we got to show these little punks how it's done, right? You know, let's go show these guys that we could still do this. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I've been playing for, you know, I never stopped playing. So yeah, I'm in.
Yeah, it was great. We, like I said, a lot of the old crew came out.
Right.
Shows were a lot of fun. Who knows if or when we'll do it again, but I'm glad we did it. You know, just getting everyone back together like that.
Yeah. Is everyone still local? Like, are you all still locals?
I just moved back here 6 months ago. You're back.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've lost a few people along the way, obviously. I mean, Tim York, Captain Beef, we lost him recently.
These are friends of the band, yeah.
You Craig Bobbitt. We lost Craig Bobbitt.
The list goes way down.
John Noki.
No, he's around.
Is he still around? I thought he was dead.
Sorry, John, you're not dead. We know that.
That's right now. Sorry about that.
Sorry. No, we did. The list of casualties is incredible. When I look back, there's a page on Facebook, Gathering of the Tribe or something. I forget what it's called, but someone created a list and everyone added to it. And it's like amazing how many people. And, you know, we're old, but we're not 80.
Right, I'm not dead yet.
But I mean, that was also the result too of just the life, not just the lifestyle, but things kind of took a turn in the mid 80s around here with a lot of stuff floating in on the beach, kind of turned the whole area around. Not necessarily for the better.
No, I would say not.
But you know, a lot of them are still around and still kicking it. And it's, you know, it's still a fun place to live. Thank God.
When you think of the legacy of Locals Only, how do you view it? And perhaps for those that aren't here, do you feel like they would share a similar idea on what the legacy of Locals Only is?
Fun.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, the legacy of Locals Only has to do with breaking open opportunities for, you know, not only for us, but, you know, for the guys that came after us and, you know, and the guys that reformed bands and all of that, you know, and breaking and helping build some sort of original music community in this area that today, believe it or not, still stands today. I challenge you to go any other place in, you know, in this area and see more live music in Brevard County. I mean, there is more live music in Brevard County today than I've seen. You know, I go to Orlando, there's no live music. There's DJs and, you know, there's just DJs and DJs. And
they're cheaper.
Yeah, they're a lot cheaper, right? But you go anywhere where you think there should be lots of entertainment, and there isn't.
Yeah, there is. And there's more venues opening up around here, I've noticed, like brand new. This place just opened in downtown O'Galley. Downtown O'Galley has a great little punk scene there. It's bar like Traditionals, Salty Fox, and then there's the Intercoastal Brewing. But I could see that coming back. I've noticed it almost seems like between 1990 and current, when alternative music just kind of got the rug pulled out from this area, the tastes kind of went more metal, more like, you know,
mainstream
metal, butt rock, that kind of thing. But the sort of indie rock scene kind of bypassed this area because there was no WFIT. There was nowhere to hear it anymore. I'd love to see, you know, Melbourne come back to being sort of up to date musically with what's out there.
But, you know,
exposure.
I would say this too. You know, I still see guys doing that though today. I mean, you know, you got Billy Chapman doing, you know, doing that kind of indie rock thing with the Billy Chapman band. There's Andrew Walker, who's just, you know, Andrew Walker is an amazing guy. He's he's involved in, you know, in youth music programs and bringing musical education alive.
Right.
While he's still, you know, the other thing that's interesting is that he surrounds all that with this island reggae kind of flavor thing. And, you know, I think there's a great community of artists here that still, you know, are doing some interesting things today. And they may not be punk and they may not be new wave and they may not be those types of music, but they're really eclectic and they really, you know, they're what's happening now.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of artists around here, really talented artists. I think there's just a lack of outlets. There's not that many outlets for it. There are some. I can't think of a single bar in the whole Cocoa, in the whole county, actually, that's a punk rock bar.
No,
or a new wave bar for live music, I mean.
Sure.
I don't think that exists anymore around here. It did.
Why do you think so much of that has gone away?
I think because of the exposure to the music is gone. When WFIT went all jazz, all that exposure went away. There was nowhere to promote it. There was nowhere to hear it unless you had the albums or whatever. And this is pre-internet, you know. I think, you know, that probably changed late in the late 90s. But I think that lull of whatever, 7-8 years, hurt it. I think, you know, and WFIT has come around more to playing a little more alternative music again. They're not all jazz anymore, which is great. So, you know, it's the area is sort of coming around to that, but I don't see a lot of outlets for it. There's a place, the Iron Oak Post, that has some punk bands now and then, but it's maybe once or twice a month. I was a little spoiled out in LA where, you know, you had five bands playing per club per night. It was almost too much to choose from, right?
Sure.
Saturated.
Yeah.
And really hard to get noticed. But I'd love to see that turning around here. And I think, like I said, there's new venues opening up now. So some that haven't even opened yet that are in the works. So.
And just with that in mind, if and when, it sounds like it's definitely a possibility that you're going to have the unreleased music from Locals Only perhaps available at some point in the future. Would there be any possibilities of Locals Only perhaps playing some shows as a result of those songs finally coming out in that album format? And perhaps maybe. Where would you want to play if you had the choice?
That's a good question. I honestly, it's so hard to say right now. You know, the various band members are in various states of existence and which I won't get into, but we would love to. I know I'm sure all of us would love to some extent. There's a lot of stuff to work out before that can happen, which may. I'd love to see it happen. I'd love to do a third reunion, especially if we do put out the album or even just some of the songs. You know, if that happens, where we'd want to do it, I'd love to do it in one of our old spots, but they're mostly gone now. So, I mean, Oliver's by the Sea's been gone for like 30 years. The Boardwalk's been gone as long. That would be ideal, but anywhere really. We used to play outside a lot. You know, it's like I said, surf contests, the Melbourne Beach Founders Day for festival.
Something, I mean, there's, you know.
Hopefully it's something kind of a, you know, with a surfy vibe and good sound, really, and can fit a good crowd. Where that winds up being, I almost don't care, really. I just I'd love to do it though.
Well, hopefully with that coming out, you know, that's definitely exciting on its own, just be able to hear some of those songs that may have never been heard before, because again, some of them you could hear, but there are, I imagine, several that perhaps have never been heard by most people. At least unless you went to a show and maybe saw the band, you played it live or something like that. So,
We just don't want to corrupt the youth of today. We're trying to keep our music hidden so that society can continue to function normal. That's the idea.
That's how I was doing it.
Yeah, I think
Thank God for telling me, because I was really worried.
I'd love to see it happen. I could see it happening within the next few years, honestly. There's really nothing holding us back at this point.
Sure. Well, that's so exciting, and certainly look forward to that. And certainly nice to have the songs that we do. And it's just been fantastic getting a chance to have you both on to tell the story of Locals Only.
Thanks for having us. It's been great.
Yeah, it's been great having you on. So as we start to get ready to close things out, I know you've shared quite a bit, but I want to kind of give you the last word. Any final thoughts you want to share to supporters of the band, friends, that sort of thing? I'm going to turn it over to you to kind of take us home.
All right. So I guess for me, I guess the thing I would want to say is, you know, through it all, through thick and thin, through everything that we've, you know, kind of gone through, the one thing I can say is thank you to Ed Gilbo, Sal Vitale, Brian Cleary, Robert Jalowski, and everybody that surrounded that band and lifted us up, you know, and made us more and better than what we were, you know. Right. A big, huge thank you for making, I mean, you created a, you know, you created amazing, you know, an amazing childhood and, you know, and young adulthood for me.
Yeah.
I don't know who I'd be without that.
I'd echo Johnny's words verbatim there. And yeah, just it was a lot of fun. We were like brothers, you know, kind of growing up together or not growing up together. But we learned how to have a lot of fun at a very young age, I would say. And that'll stick with me forever.
You know, and we also learned how to play music together. Yeah. We learned how to do something bigger than ourselves. Right. And I think that was a huge lesson, a life lesson that I think all of us really kind of took with us.
And yeah, get out and support local music. And
please do.
And Jeff, thanks for having us. This has been great. This is the first time we've ever done anything like this, at least since, you know, 1986.
So. Right.
There weren't a lot of podcasts going on back then.
So. No.
Yeah. But anyway, thanks for having us.